I remember how the birds sang that afternoon, and how I could hear some of the people out on the reach yelling back and forth to each other, their voices all tiny and far. They sounded like voices on the radio. I can even remember what I was humming. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. I went on humming it while I made my crackers and cheese. I didn't want them any more than a hen wants a flag, but I didn't want Joe wondering why I wasn't eating either. It must have been 2:15 or so when I went back out on the porch with the tray of food balanced in one hand like a waitress and the bag Vera'd give me in the other. The sky was still overcast, but you could see it really had gotten quite a bit lighter. That was a good little feed, as things turned out. Joe wasn't much for compliments, but I could see from the way he put down his paper and looked at his sandwich while he was eating that he liked it. I thought of something I'd read in some book or saw in some movie. The condemned man ate a hearty meal. Once I'd got that in my head, I couldn't get rid of the damn thing. It didn't stop me from digging into my own kip, though. Once I got started, I kept going until every one of those cheese and cracker things were gone. And I drank a whole bottle of Pepsi as well. Once or twice, I found myself wondering if most executioners have good appetites on the days when they have to do their job. It's funny what a person's mind will get up to when that person's nerving herself up to do something, isn't it? The sun broke through the clouds just as we were finishing up. I thought of what Vera'd told me that morning, looked down at my watch and smiled. It was 3:00, right on the button. About that same time, Dave Pelletier, he delivered mail on the island back in those days, drove back toward town, hell-bent for election, and pulling a long rooster tail of dust behind him. I didn't see another car on East Lane until long after dark. I put the plates and my empty soda bottle on the tray, scooching down to do it, and before I could stand up, Joe done something he hadn't done in years. Put one of his hands on the back of my neck and give me a kiss. I fared better. His breath was all booze and onion and salami, and he hadn't shaved. But it was a kiss just the same, and nothing mean or half-assed or peckish about it. It was just a nice kiss, and I couldn't remember the last time he'd given me one. I closed my eyes and let him do it. I remember that. Closing my eyes and feeling his lips on mine and the sun on my forehead. One was as warm and nice as the other. "That weren't half bad, Dolores," he said, which was high praise coming from him. I had a second there when I kind of wavered. I ain't gonna sit here and say different. It was a second when it wasn't Joe putting his hands all over Selena that I saw, but the way his forehead looked in study hall back in 1945. How I saw that and wanted him to kiss me just the way he was kissing me now. How I thought, if he kissed me, I'd reach up and touch the skin there on his brow while he did it. See if it's as smooth as it looks. I reached out my hand and touched it then, just like I'd dreamed of doing all those years before, when I'd been nothing but a green girl. And the minute I did, that inside eye opened wider than ever. What it saw was how he'd go on if I let him go on, not just getting what he wanted from Selena, or spending the money he'd robbed out of his kids' bank accounts, but working on him, belittling Joe Jr. for his good grades and his love of history, clapping little Pete on the back whenever Pete called somebody a kike, or said one of his classmates was lazy as a nigger. Working on him, always working on him. He'd go on until they were broke or spoiled if I let him. And in the end, he'd die and leave us with nothing but bills and a hole to bury him in. Well, I had a hole for him, one 30 feet deep instead of just 6, and lined with chunks of fieldstone instead of dirt. You bet I had a hole for him. And one kiss after 3 years, or maybe even 5, wasn't going to change it. Neither was touching his forehead, which had been a lot more the cause of all my trouble than his puling little dingus ever was. But I touched it again just the same, traced one finger over it, and thought about how he kissed me on the patio of the Samoset Inn while the band inside played Moonlight Cocktail, and how I'd been able to smell his father's cologne on his cheeks when he did. Then I hardened my heart. "I'm glad," I said, and picked up the tray again. "Why don't you see what you can make of those viewers and the reflector boxes while I do up these few dishes?" "I don't give a fuck about anything that rich cunt gave you," he says. "And I don't give a fuck about the goddamn eclipse either. I've seen dark before. It happens every goddamn night." "All right," I says. "Suit yourself." I got as far as the door, and he says, "Maybe you and me can get up to Dickens later on. What would you think about that, Dee?" "Maybe," I says, all the time thinking there was going to be plenty of Dickens, all right. Before it got dark for the second time that day, Joe St. George was going to get more Dickens than he'd ever dreamed of. I kept my good weather eye on him while I was standing at the sink and doing up our few dishes. He hadn't done anything in bed but sleep, snore, and fart for years, and I think he knew as well as I did that the booze had as much to do with that as my ugly face. Probably more. I was scared that maybe the idea of getting his ashes hauled later on would cause him to put the cap back on that bottle of Johnny Walker. But no such bad luck. For Joe, fucking, pardon my language, Nancy, was just a fancy, like kissing me had been. The bottle was a lot realer to him. The bottle was right there where he could touch it. He'd gotten one of the eclipse viewers out of the bag and was holding it up by the handle, turning it this way and that, squinting at the sun through it. He reminded me of a thing I saw on TV once, a chimpanzee trying to tune a radio. Then he put it down and poured himself another drink. When I came back out on the porch with my sewing basket, I saw he was already getting that owly, red-around-the-eyes look he had when he was on his way from moderately tickled to thoroughly tanked. He looked at me pretty sharp, just the same, no doubt wondering if I was going to bitch at him. "Don't mind me," I says, sweet as sugar pie. "I'm just going to sit here and do a little mending and wait for the eclipse to start. It's nice that the sun came out, isn't it?" "Christ, Dolores, you must think this is my birthday," he says. His voice had started to get thick and furry. "Well, something like it, maybe," I says, and began sewing up a rip in a pair of little Pete's jeans. The next hour and a half passed slower than any time had since I was a little girl, and my Aunt Cloris promised to come and take me to my first movie down in Ellsworth. I finished little Pete's jeans, sewed patches on two pairs of Joe Jr.'s chinos. Even back then, that boy would absolutely not wear jeans. I think part of him had already decided he was going to be a politician when he grew up. And hemmed two of Selena's skirts. The last thing I did was sew a new fly in one of Joe's two or three pairs of good slacks. They were old, but not entirely worn out. I remember thinking they would do to bury him in. Then, just when I thought it was never going to happen, I noticed the light on my hand seemed a little dimmer. "Dolores," Joe says, "I think this is what you and all the rest of the fools have been waiting for." "Yeah," I says, "I guess." The light in the dooryard had gone from that strong afternoon yellow it has in July to a kind of faded rose, and the shadow of the house laying across the driveway had taken on a funny, thin kind of look I'd never seen before and never have since. I took one of the reflector boxes from the bag, held it out the way Vera'd showed me about 100 times in the last week or so, and when I did, I had the funniest thought. "That little girl is doing this too," I thought. "The one who's sitting on her father's lap. She's doing this very same thing." I didn't know what that thought meant then, Andy. And I don't really know now. But I'm telling you anyway, because I made up my mind I'd tell you everything. And because I thought of her again later. Except in the next second or two, I wasn't just thinking of her. I was seeing her. The way you see people in dreams. Or the way I guess the Old Testament prophets must have seen things in their visions. A little girl, maybe 10 years old, with her own reflector box in her hands. She wearing a short dress with red and yellow stripes. A A kind of sundress with straps instead of sleeves, you know. And lipstick, the color of peppermint candy. Her hair was blonde and put up in the back, like she wanted to look older than she really was. I saw something else as well, something that made me think of Joe. Her daddy's hand was on her leg, way up high. Higher than it ought to have been, maybe. Then it was gone. "Dolores," Joe asked me. "You all right?" "What do you mean?" I asks back. "Course I am." "You looked funny there for a minute." "It's just the eclipse," I says. And I really think that's what it was, Andy. But I also think that little girl I saw then and again later was a real little girl, and that she was sitting with her father somewhere else along the path of the eclipse at the same time I was sitting on the back porch with Joe. I looked down in the box and seen a little tiny white sun, so bright it was like looking at a 50-cent piece on fire, with a dark curve bit into one side of it. I looked at it for a little while, then at Joe. He was holding up one of the viewers, peering into it. "God damn," he says. I didn't know if he'd changed his mind or if it was the booze talking and didn't care. "She's disappearing, all right." The crickets started to sing in the grass right about then. I guess they'd decided sundown was coming early that day and it was time for them to crank up. I looked out on the reach at all the boats and saw the water they were floating on looked a darker blue now. There was something about them that was creepy and wonderful at the same time. My brain kept trying to believe that all those boats sitting there under that funny dark summer sky were just a hallucination. I glanced at my watch and saw it was going on 10 till 5. Still over half an hour until the eclipse would be total, which meant that for the next hour or so, everyone on the island would be thinking about nothing else and watching nothing else. East Lane was dead empty. Our neighbors were either on the Island Princess or the hotel roof. And if I really meant to do him, the time had come. My guts felt like they were all wound into one big spring, and I couldn't quite get that thing I'd seen, the little girl sitting on her daddy's lap, out of my mind. But I couldn't let either of those things stop me or even distract me, not for a single minute. I knew if I didn't do it right then, I wouldn't ever. I put the reflector box down beside my sewing and said, "Joe." "What?" he asked me. He'd pooh-poohed the eclipse before, but now that it had actually started, it seemed like he couldn't take his eyes off it. His head was tipped back, and the eclipse viewer he was looking through cast one of those funny faded shadows on his face. "It's time for the surprise," I said. "What surprise?" he asks. And when he lowered the eclipse viewer, which was just this double layer of special polarized glass in a frame, if I ain't already said so, to look at me, I saw it wasn't fascination with the eclipse after all, or not completely. He was halfway to being shit-faced, and so groggy I got a little scared. If he didn't understand what I was saying, my plan was buggered before it even got started. What was I going to do then? I didn't know. The only thing I did know scared the hell out of me. I wasn't going to turn back. No matter how wrong things went or what happened later, I wasn't going to turn back. Then he reached out a hand, grabbed me by the shoulder, and shook me. "What in God's name you talking about, woman?" he says. "You know the money in the kids' bank accounts?" I asks him. His eyes narrowed a little, and I saw he wasn't anywhere near as drunk as I'd first thought. I understood something else, too. That one kiss didn't change a thing. Anyone can give a kiss, after all. A kiss was how Judas Iscariot showed the Romans which one was Jesus. "What about it?" he says. "You took it. Like hell." "Oh, yes," I says. "After I found out you'd been fooling with Selena, I went to the bank. I meant to withdraw the money, then take the kids and get them away from you." His mouth dropped open, and for a few seconds he just gaped at me. Then he started to laugh. Just leaned back in his rocker and laughed while the day went on getting darker all around him. "Well, you got fooled, didn't you?" he says. Then he helped himself to a little more scotch, and looked up at the sky through the eclipse viewer again. This time I couldn't hardly see the shadow on his face. "Half gone, Dolores," he says. "Half gone now, maybe a little more." I looked down into my reflector box and seen he was right. Only half of that 50-cent piece was left, and more was going all the time. "Yeah," I says, "half gone, so it is. As to the money, Joe..." "You just forget that," he told me. "Don't trouble your pointy little head about it. That money's just about fine." "Oh, I'm not worried about it," I says, "not a bit. The way you fooled me, though, that weighs on my mind." He nodded, kind of solemn and thoughtful, as if to show me he understood and even sympathized. But he couldn't hold on to the expression. Pretty soon he busted out laughing again, like a little kid who's getting scolded by a teacher he ain't in the least afraid of. He laughed so hard he sprayed a little silver cloud of spit into the air in front of his mouth. "I'm sorry, Dolores," he says when he was able to talk again. "I don't mean to laugh, but I did steal a march on you, didn't I?" "Oh, yeah," I agreed. It wasn't nothing but the truth, after all. "Fooled you right and proper," he says, laughing and shaking his head the way you do when someone tells a real knee-slapper. "Yeah," I agreed along with him. "But you know what they say." "Nope," he says. He dropped the eclipse viewer into his lap and turned to look at me. He'd laughed so hard there were tears standing in his piggy little bloodshot eyes. "You're the one with a saying for every occasion, Dolores. What do they say about husbands who finally put one over on their meddling busybody wives?" "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me," I says. "You fooled me about Selena, and then you fooled me about the money. But I guess I finally caught up to you." "Well, maybe you did and maybe you didn't," he says. "But if you're worried about it being spent, you can just stop, because..." I broke in there. "I ain't worried," I says. "I told you that already. I ain't a bit worried." He give me a hard look then, Andy, his smile drying up little by little. "You got that smart look on your face again," he says. "The one I don't much care for." "Tough titty," I says. He looked at me for a long time, trying to figure out what was going on inside my head. But I guess it was as much a mystery to him then as ever. He pooched his lip out again and sighed so hard he blew back the lock of hair that had fallen on his forehead. "Most women don't understand the first thing about money, Dolores," he says, "and you're no exception to the rule. I put it all together in one account, that's all. So it'd draw more interest. I didn't tell you because I didn't want to listen to a lot of your ignorant bullshit. Well, I've had to listen to some anyway, like I just about always do, but enough's enough." Then he raised up the eclipse viewer again to show me the subject was closed. "One account in your own name," I says. "So what?" he asked. By then it was like we were sitting in a deep twilight, and the trees had begun fading against the horizon. I could hear a whippoorwill singing from behind the house and a nightjar from somewhere else. It felt like the temperature had begun to drop, too. It all gave me the strangest feeling, like living in a dream that somehow turned real. "Why shouldn't it be in my name? I'm their father, ain't I?" "Well, your blood is in 'em. If that makes you a father, I guess you are one." I could see him trying to figure out if that one was worth picking up and yanking on for a while, and deciding it weren't. "You don't want to talk about this any more, Dolores," he says. "I'm warning you." "Well, maybe just a little more," I says, back, smiling. "You forgot all about the surprise, you see." He looked at me suspicious again. "What the fuck are you babbling on about, Dolores?" "Well, I went to see the man in charge of the savings department at Coastal Northern in Johnsport," I says. "A nice man named Mr. Pease. I explained what happened, and he was awful upset, especially when I told him the original savings books weren't missing, like you told him they were." That was when Joe lost what little interest in the eclipse he'd had. He just sat there in that shitty old rocker of his, staring at me with his eyes wide open. There was thunder on his brow, and his lips were pressed down into a thin white line like a scar. He dropped the eclipse viewer back into his lap, and his hands were opening and closing real slow. "It turned out you weren't supposed to do that," I told him. "Mr. Pease checked to see if the money was still in the bank. When he found out it was, we both heaved a big sigh of relief. He asked me if I wanted him to call the cops and tell him what happened. I could see from his face he was hoping like hell I'd say no. I asked if he could issue that money over to me. He looked it up in a book and said he could. So I said, 'That's what we'll do then.' And he did it. So that's why I ain't worried about the kid's money anymore, Joe. I've got it now instead of you. Ain't that a corker of a surprise?" "You lie!" Joe shouted at me and stood up so fast his rocker almost fell over. The eclipse viewer fell out of his lap and broke to pieces when it hit the porch floor. I wish I had a picture of the way he looked just then. I'd stuck it to him, all right, and it went in all the way to the hilt. The expression on the dirty son of a whore's face was pretty near worth everything I'd been through since that day on the ferry with Selina. "They can't do that," he yells. "You can't touch a cent of that dough. Can't even look at the fucking passbook." "Oh, no," I says. "Then how come I know you already spent 300 of it? I'm thankful it wasn't more, but it still makes me mad as hell every time I think of it. You're nothing but a thief, Joe St. George. One so low he'd even steal from his own children." His face was as white as a corpse's in the gloom. Only his eyes was alive, and they were burning with hate. His hands was held out in front of him, opening and closing, opening and closing. I glanced down for just a second and saw the sun, less than half by then, just a fat crescent, reflected over and over in the shattered pieces of smoked glass laying around his feet. Then I looked back at him again. It wouldn't do to take my eyes off him for long, not with the mood he was in. "What did you spend that 300 on, Joe? Whores? Poker? Some of both? I know it wa'n't another junker, because there ain't any new ones out back." He didn't say nothing, just stood there in front of me with his hands opening and closing, and behind him I could see the first lightning bugs stitching their lights across the dooryard. The boats out on the reach were just ghosts by then, and I thought of Vera. I figured if she wasn't in seventh heaven already, she was probably in the vestibule. Not that I had any business thinking about Vera. It was Joe I had to keep my mind on. I wanted to get him moving, and I judged one more good push should do it. "I guess I don't care what you spent it on anyway," I says. "I got the rest, and that's good enough for me. You can just go fuck yourself. If you can get your old limp noodle to stand up, that is." He stumbled across the porch, crunching the pieces of the eclipse viewer under his shoes, and grabbed me by the arms. I could have gotten away from him, but I didn't want to, not just then. "You want to watch your fresh mouth," he whispered, blowing scotch fumes down into my face. "If you don't, I'm apt to." "Mr. Pease wanted me to put the money back in the bank, but I wouldn't. I figured if you were able to get it out of the kids' accounts, you might find a way to get it out of mine, too. Then he wanted to give me a check, but I was afraid that if you found out what I was up to before I wanted you to find out, you might stop payment on it. So I told Mr. Pease to give it to me in cash. He didn't like it, but in the end he did it, and now I have it, every cent, and I've put it in a place where it's safe." He grabbed me by the throat then. I was pretty sure he would, and I was scared, but I wanted it, too. It'd make him believe the last thing I had to say that much more when I finally said it. But even that wa'n't the most important thing. Having him grab me by the throat like that made it seem more like self-defense somehow. That was the most important thing. And it was self-defense, no matter what the law might say about it. I know, because I was there, and the law wasn't. In the end, I was defending myself, and I was defending my children. He cut off my wind and throttled me back and forth, yelling. I don't remember all of it. I think he must have knocked my head against one of the porch posts once or twice. I was a goddamn bitch, he said. He'd kill me if I didn't give that money back. That money was his. Foolishness like that. I began to be afraid he really would kill me before I could tell him what he wanted to hear. The dooryard had gotten a lot darker, and it seemed full of those little stitching lights, as if the 100 or 200 fireflies I'd seen before had been joined by 10,000 or so more. And his voice sounded so far away that I thought it had all gone wrong somehow, that I'd fallen down the well instead of him. Finally, he let me go. I tried to stay on my feet, but my legs wouldn't hold me. I tried to fall back into the chair I'd been sitting in, but he'd yanked me too far away from it, and my ass just clipped the edge of the seat on my way down. I landed on the porch floor, next to the litter of broken glass that was all that was left of his eclipse viewer. There was one big piece left, with a crescent of sun shining in it like a jewel. I started to reach for it, then didn't. I wasn't going to cut him, even if he gave me the chance. I couldn't cut him. A cut like that, a glass cut, might not look right later. So you see how I was thinking. Not much doubt any place along the line about whether or not it was first degree, is there, Andy? Instead of the glass, I grabbed hold of my reflector box, which was made of some heavy wood. I could say I was thinking it would do to bash him with if it came to that, but it wouldn't be true. Right then, I really wasn't thinking much at all. I was coughing, though. Coughing so damned hard, it seemed a wonder to me that I wasn't spraying blood as well as spit. My throat felt like it was on fire. He pulled me back onto my feet so hard one of my slip straps broke, then caught the nape of my neck in the crook of his arm and yanked me toward him until we was close enough to kiss. Not that he was in a kissing mood anymore. I told you what had happened if you didn't leave off being so fresh with me, he says. His eyes were all wet and funny, like he'd been crying. But what scared me about him was the way they seemed to be looking right through me, as if I wasn't really there for him anymore. I told you a million times. Do you believe me now, Dolores? Yes, I said. He'd hurt my throat so bad I sounded like I was talking through a throat full of mud. Yes, I do. Say it again, he says. He still had my neck caught in the crook of his elbow, and now he squeezed so hard it pinched one of the nerves in there. I screamed. I couldn't help it. It hurt dreadful. That made him grin. Say it like you mean it, he told me. I do, I screamed. I do mean it. I'd planned on acting frightened, but Joe saved me the trouble. I didn't have to do no acting that day, after all. Good, he says. I'm glad to hear it. Now tell me where the money is, and every red cent better be there. It's out back of the woodshed, I says. I didn't sound like I was talking through a mouthful of mud anymore. By then I sounded like Groucho Marx on You Bet Your Life, which sort of fit the situation, if you see what I mean. Then I told him I put the money in a jar and hid the jar in the blackberry bushes. Just like a woman, he sneers, and then give me a shove toward the porch steps. Well, come on, let's go get it. I walked down the porch steps and along the side of the house with Joe right behind me. By then it was almost as dark as it gets at night, and when we reached the shed, I saw something so strange it made me forget everything else for a few seconds. I stopped and pointed up into the sky over the blackberry tangle. Look, Joe, I says, stars. And there were. I could see the Big Dipper at 5:15 on that summer's afternoon as clear as I ever saw it on a winter's night. It gave me goosebumps all over my body. But it wasn't nothing to Joe. He gave me a shove so hard I almost fell over. Stars, he says, you'll see plenty of them if you don't quit stalling, woman. I guarantee you that. I started walking again. Our shadows had completely disappeared, and the big white rock where me and Selina had sat that evening the year before stood out almost as bright as a spotlight, like I've noticed it does when there's a full moon. The light wasn't like moonlight, Andy. I can't describe what it was like, how gloomy and weird it was, but it'll have to do. I know that the distances between things had gotten hard to judge, like they do in moonlight, and that you couldn't pick out any single blackberry bush anymore. They were all just one big smear with those fireflies dancing back and forth in front of them. Vera'd told me time and time again that it was dangerous to look straight at the eclipse. She said it could burn your retinas or even blind you. Still, I couldn't no more resist turning my head and taking one quick glance up over my shoulder than Lot's wife could resist taking one last glance back at the city of Sodom. What I saw has stayed in my memory ever since. Weeks, sometimes whole months, go by without me thinking about Joe, but hardly a day goes by when I don't think of what I saw that afternoon when I looked up over my shoulder and into the sky. Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt because she couldn't keep her eyes front and her mind on her business, and I've sometimes thought it's a wonder I didn't have to pay the same price. The eclipse wasn't total yet, but it was close. The sky itself was a deep royal purple, and what I saw hanging in it above the reach looked like a big black pupil with a gauzy veil of fire spread out most of the way around it. On one side, there was a thin crescent of sun still left, like beads of molten gold in a blast furnace. I had no business looking at such a sight, and I knew it. But once I had, it seemed like I couldn't look away. It was like, well, you might laugh, but I'm going to say it anyway. It was like that inside eye had gotten free of me somehow, that it had floated up into the sky and was looking down to see how I was going to make out. But it was so much bigger than I'd ever imagined, so much blacker. I probably would have looked at it until I went stone blind, except Joe gave me another shove and bashed me into the shed wall. That kind of woke me up, and I started walking again. There was a great big blue spot, the kind you see after someone takes a flash picture, hanging in front of me, and I thought, if you burned your retinas and have to look at that for the rest of your life, it'll serve you right, Dolores. It wouldn't be no more than the mark Cain had to bear. We walked past the white rock, Joe right behind me and holding on to the neck of my dress. I could feel my slip sliding down one side where the strap had broken. What with the dark and that big blue spot hanging in the middle of things, everything looked off kilter and out of place. The end of the shed wasn't nothing but a dark shape, like someone had taken a pair of shears and cut a roof-shaped hole in the sky. He pushed me toward the edge of the blackberry patch, and when the first thorn prinked my calf, I remembered that this time I'd forgot to put on my jeans. It made me wonder what else I might have forgot, but of course it was too late to change anything then. I could see that little scrap of cloth fluttering in the last of the light, and had just time to remember how the well cap lay beneath it. Then I tore out of his fist and pelted into the brambles, hell-bent for election. "No, you don't, you bitch!" he bawls at me, and I could hear the bushes breaking as he trampled in after me. I felt his hand grab for the neck of my dress again and almost catch. I jerked loose and kept on going. It was hard to run because my slip was falling down and kept hooking on the brambles. In the end, they unraveled a great long strip of it and took plenty of meat off my legs as well. I was bloody from knees to ankles, but I never noticed till I got back in the house, and that was a long time after. "Come back here," he bellowed, and this time I felt his hand on my arm. I yanked it free, and so he grabbed at my slip, which was floating out behind me like a bridal train by then. If it had held, he might have reeled me in like a big fish. But it was old and tired from being washed 200 or 300 times. I felt the strip he'd got hold of tear away and heard him curse, kind of high and out of breath. I could hear the sound of the brambles breaking and snapping and whipping in the air, but couldn't see hardly anything. Once we was in the blackberry tangle, it was darker than a woodchuck's asshole. And in the end, that hanky I tied up wasn't any help. I saw the edge of the well cap instead, no more than a glimmer of white in the darkness just ahead of me, and I jumped with all my might. I just cleared it, and because I was facing away from him, I didn't actually see him step onto it. There was a big crack sound, and then he hollered. No, that ain't right. He didn't holler. And I guess you know it as well as I do. He screamed, like a rabbit with its foot caught in a slipwire. I turned around and seen a big hole in the middle of the cap. Joe's head was sticking out of it, and he was holding on to one of those smashed boards with all his might. His hands were bleeding, and there was a little thread of blood running down his chin from the corner of his mouth. His eyes were the size of doorknobs. "Oh, Christ, Dolores," he says. "It's the old well. Help me out quick before I fall all the way in." I just stood there, and after a few seconds his eyes changed. I seen the understanding of what it had all been about come into him. I was never so scared as I was then, standing there on the far side of the well cap and staring at him with that black sun hanging in the sky to the west of us. I had forgot my jeans, and he hadn't fallen right in like he was supposed to. To me, it seemed like everything had started going wrong. "Oh," he said. "Oh, you bitch." Then he started to claw and wriggle his way up. I told myself I had to run, but my legs wouldn't move. Where was there to run to, anyway, if he got out? One thing I found out on the day of the eclipse, if you live on an island and you try to kill someone, you better do a good job. If you don't, there's nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. I could hear his fingernails scratching up splinters in that old board as he worked at pulling himself out, hand over hand. That sound is like what I saw when I looked up at the eclipse, something that's always been a lot closer to me than I ever wanted it to be. Sometimes I even hear it in my dreams, only in the dreams he gets out and comes after me again. And that ain't what really happened. What happened was the board he was clawing his way along all of a sudden snapped under his weight, and he dropped. It happened so fast, it was almost like he'd never been there in the first place. All at once, there was nothing there but a saggy gray square of wood with a ragged black hole in the middle of it, and fireflies zipping back and forth over it. He screamed again going down. It echoed off the sides of the well. That was something else I hadn't figured on, him screaming when he fell. Then there was a thud, and he stopped, just flat stopped, the way a lamp stops shining if someone yanks the plug out of the wall. I knelt on the ground and hugged my arms across my middle and waited to see if there was going to be any more. Some time went by, I don't know how much or how long, but the last of the light went out of the day. The total eclipse had come, and it was dark as night. There still wasn't any sound coming from the well, but there was a little breeze coming from it toward me, and I realized I could smell it. You know that smell you sometimes get in water that comes from shallow wells? It's a coppery smell, dank, not very nice. I could smell that, and it made me shiver. I saw my slip was hanging down almost to the top of my left shoe. It was all torn and full of rips. I reached under the neck of my dress on the right side and popped that strap, too. Then I pulled the slip down and off. I was bundling it into a ball beside me and trying to see the best way to skirt around the well cap when all at once I thought of that little girl again, the one I told you about before, and all at once I saw her just as clear as day. She was down on her knees, too, looking under her bed, and I thought, she's so unhappy, and she smells that same smell, the one that's like pennies and oysters, only it didn't come from the well. It has something to do with her father. And then all at once, it was like she looked around at me, Andy. I think she saw me. And when she did, I understood why she was so unhappy. Her father had been at her somehow, and she was trying to cover it up. On top of that, she'd all at once realized someone was looking at her. That a woman God knows how many miles away but still in the path of the eclipse, a woman who just killed her husband, was looking at her. She spoke to me, although I didn't hear her voice with my ears. It came from deep in the middle of my head. "Who are you?" she asked. I don't know if I would have answered her or not, But before I even had a chance to, a long, wavering scream came out of the well. Dolores! It felt like my blood froze solid inside me, and I know my heart stopped for a second, because when it started again, it had to catch up with three or four beats all crammed together. I'd picked the slip up, but my fingers relaxed when I heard that scream, and it fell out of my hand and caught on one of those blackberry bushes. It's just your imagination working overtime, Dolores, I told myself. That little girl looking under the bed for her clothes and Joe screaming like that, you imagined them both. One was a hallucination that somehow come of catching a whiff of stale air from the well, and the other was no more than your own guilty conscience. Joe's laying at the bottom of that well with his head bashed in. He's dead, and he ain't gonna bother either you or the kids ever again. I didn't believe it at first, but more time went by and there was no more sound, except for an owl calling somewhere off in a field. I remember thinking it sounded like he was asking how come his shift was getting started so early today. A little breeze ran through the blackberry bushes, making them rattle. I looked up at the stars shining in the daytime sky, then down at the well cap again. It almost seemed to float in the dark, and the hole in the middle he'd fallen through looked like an eye to me. July 20th, 1963 was my day for seeing eyes everywhere. Then his voice come drifting out of the well again. Help me, Dolores! I groaned and put my hands over my face. It wasn't any good trying to tell myself that was just my imagination, or my guilty conscience, or anything else except what it was, Joe. To me, he sounded like he was crying. Help me, please, please, he moaned. I stumbled my way around the well cap and went running back along the path we'd beat in the brambles. I wasn't in a panic, not quite, and I'll tell you how I know that. I stopped long enough to pick up the reflector box I'd had in my hand when we started out toward the blackberry patch. I couldn't remember dropping it as I ran, but when I saw it hanging off one of those branches, I grabbed it. Probably a damn good thing, too, considering how things went with that damn Dr. McAuliffe. But that's still a turn or two around the track from where I am now. I did stop to pick it up, that's the point. And to me that says I was still in possession of my wits. I could feel the panic trying to reach underneath them, though, the way a cat will try to get his paw under the lid of a box if it's hungry and it can smell food inside. I thought about Selena, and that helped keep the panic away. I could imagine her standing on the beach of Lake Winthrop, along with Tanya and 40 or 50 little campers, each camper with his or her own reflector box that they'd made in the handicrafts cabin, and the girls showing them exactly how to see the eclipse in them. It wasn't as clear as the vision I'd had out by the well, the one of the little girl looking under the bed for her shorts and shirt, but it was clear enough for me to hear Selena talking to the little ones in that slow, kind voice of hers, soothing the ones who were afraid. I thought about that, and about how I had to be here for her and her brothers when they got back. Only if I gave in to the panic, I probably wouldn't be. I'd gone too far and done too much, and there wasn't nobody left I could count on except myself. I went into the shed and found Joe's big six-cell flashlight on his work table. I turned it on, but nothing happened. He let the batteries go flat, which was just like him. I keep the bottom drawer of his table stocked with fresh ones, though, because we lose the power so often in the winter. I got half a dozen and tried to fill the flashlight up again. My hands were trembling so bad the first time that I dropped D-cells all over the floor and had to scramble for them. The second time I got them in, but I must have put one or two in bass-ackwards in my hurry because the light wouldn't come on. I thought about just leaving it. The sun'd be coming out again pretty soon, after all. Except it'd be dark at the bottom of the well even after it did come out. And besides, there was a voice in the very back of my mind telling me to keep on fiddling and diddling just as long as I wanted. That maybe if I took long enough, I'd find he'd finally given up the ghost when I did get back out there. At last, I got the flash to work. It made a fine bright light, and before long I found myself wishing it showed less than it did. But at least I was able to find my way back to the well cap without scratching my legs any worse than they already were. I don't have the slightest idea how much time had gone by, but it was still gloomy and there were still stars showing in the sky, so I guess it wasn't yet 6, and the sun still mostly covered.